Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Bob Moses. I'm the chair of the AES Seattle section, no, Pacific Northwest, I'm sorry. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight. Look at this crowd. This is awesome. We are so thrilled to have the one and only Jack Endino here to teach us about mic and guitars. Wow. So thank you for being here, Jack. This is going to be so fun.
Running the AES elections.
Take the microphone.
Just to brag on Gary a little bit, he's going to be taking over the AES global elections here pretty soon. End of the year, right? Next year, I guess. Next election cycle. So if you want to get elected president, just go buy this guy a coffee. And it's easy.
Martinis work better.
Yeah, not with Gary. He's a straight man. Lots to talk about here. So for those of you who are new, not been to one of our meetings before, we meet every month. And last month we had two meetings. We had an exciting meeting with Jim Anderson and Ulrika Schwartz, who are two of the preeminent surround sound recordists in the world. And they came and played some really amazing stuff in an Atmos theater at Microsoft, which was a lot of fun. And then we had a couple of scientists talking about math. I won't even get into what that was. And then we have Jack doing rock and roll. We're all over the map. We have a lot of fun. And I hope that you guys will all come back. And like Steve was saying, I would ask anybody who's not a member to consider joining us and becoming a member. There's a lot of benefits. You get discounts from Apple and Dell and Focal Press books. And if you're a student, which sounds like many of you are, there's like a whole suite of free plugins you get from iZotope as an AS member, worth hundreds of dollars, way more than your membership fee. You get access to every audio research paper ever published by the AS going back to the 1950s. And that's like the history of the entire industry, you know, with stereo recording and analog, digital, and MP3, all of that is documented. There's videos that are recorded at all the international events that AES does, and those are available to members. There's events like this where you can network and meet people and get mentors, and it's really a great organization. So please really do consider joining. And if you have questions about how to join, talk to any of us with these little blue badges during the break tonight. I'm going to turn the floor over to Greg, who will introduce our speaker tonight.
I'm really excited tonight to be able to introduce our guest, Jack Endino. Jack has an electrical engineering degree from University of Washington. Jack's been an active engineer and producer since the mid-80s. He's worked on a number of very important records, including engineering and production for Nirvana's Bleach, their debut record. Jack has also worked with other seminal grunge rock bands, including Soundgarden, Mudhoney, Tad, and L7. He's helped define the sound of Seattle's rock music, and he continues to define Seattle's sound as an active producer, engineer, and musician. On a personal note, as a teenager growing up in the Midwest, listening to Bleach made me feel like I was in the room with the band, and I imagined I was there. For me, grunge rock and the electric guitar were an important gateway to becoming an audio engineer. If you enjoy our meeting tonight, as Steve and Bob mentioned, please consider joining our group. And without further ado, please welcome Jack.
Thank you. Well, everything that he mentioned as far as bands I've worked with, all of that was prior to 1989. So if you were to have a career as a recording engineer, your mileage might vary a little bit. I suppose I was in the right place at the right time with, in retrospect, it was the right aesthetic that the music demanded. Since then, I mean, that was 1986 when I got my first real job in a recording studio, which was Reciprocal Recording. Reciprocal Recording was, we took over for a studio called Triangle Recording that had been in a strange triangular building in Fremont since the mid-70s. And I'm sure that I think there's probably a lot of strange stories about that studio, that not all of which have come down to me, but I used to hear about it when people would come by. After we took over the building in 86, random people would come by looking for their tapes. A guy even came by looking for his piano that he said he had left at the old Triangle space years earlier. Sorry, dude. But we had a Reciprocal had a pretty good run for about 5 years, and then the owner, Chris Hanzik, he went into mastering, which he's been doing ever since. Possibly a wise thing to do, actually. I still send him records to master. And I went freelance in 1991 when my band Skinyard broke up, and simultaneously the grunge thing blew up, and everybody wanted me to record their records. So I thought, the world wants me to be an engineer, not a guitar player. Silly me, I'm still in four bands 30 years later. But, you know, that is not how I keep a roof over my head. I do mastering, I do mixing, I do production, I do recording. Pretty much, you know, I mow lawns, whatever. So I am here to talk about guitar because I seem to be a guitar guy. I'm a rock and roll guy. Now, there's over 500 albums on my discography at this point from 14 countries other than the U.S. are included in that. Not all of them I've... Well, no, that's 14 countries that I've actually been to work to record bands. There's probably others that people have just sent me their files, like some band in Indonesia sent me some stuff to master. You just never know. That band sounded like Dinosaur Jr. Who knew? You know, I don't know what language it was in, but that's what it sounded like. I thought, okay, it's this stuff is everywhere. So I get around with this thing, the so-called grunge explosion, which really was over with, you know, 25 years ago. The waves of it went out, and I just kept working, making records. I'm trying to avoid bands that sound stereotypically Seattle. That's how I ended up going to other countries. I was ready, like, oh, you got a band, you're in Portugal? Great, I'll do it, you know. And that's been really good because I now have clients all over the world who send me stuff. But my taste for music tends toward guitar bands in the broadest possible sense. Now, earlier this year, I won my first Grammy. It's a Latin Grammy for a pop record that I made for a Brazilian guy that I've been working with since 1993. He's now a big star in Brazil. Nando Reis is his name. And we recorded part of the record here in Seattle. My friend Barrett Martin went to Brazil and recorded the rest of it down there, and then we mixed it here in Seattle, and we both got a Latin Grammy for a record that nobody in the United States is ever going to hear, and it's in Portuguese. Even the Grammy is in Portuguese, you know. And so, it's the most ungrunge thing imaginable, but there it is. I'm really a secret pop guy. But I'm here to talk about guitar. Which was not my first instrument. My first instrument was drums, and then at some point when I felt I could get away with it, I switched to playing bass, and then at a certain point people allowed me to play guitar, and here we are. So the challenge with electric guitar, and I'm going to stick with electric guitar, the challenge with electric guitar is that it's basically a white noise instrument with no dynamic range. It's either on or it's off, as commonly used in most rock music. Okay, and this is like a big deal because prior to electric guitar coming on the scene, I'm not sure, I don't know the exact historical timeline, but let's say mid-50s sometime, late-50s, I don't know, when it started appearing in popular music, instruments had attack and decay envelopes, and naturally they had sort of like real-time acoustic instruments, things that you would blow a reed or you'd bang on a piano keyboard. They were percussion, they had attack, they had release, there was decay, there was space between the notes. Things had fairly natural frequency responses. And then the guitar comes along, and it's basically a giant wall of white noise with no holes in it. And as used commonly, it still has no holes in it. And so you're figured, and now consider the human voice for a minute and the challenge that I have on a daily basis when I'm mixing records that are drenched in loud rock guitar. What is the most dynamic thing you can think of? It's probably a human voice, you know, or maybe a violin or something like that. But any, you know, the organic things that are natural and organic tend to go quiet and loud and get quiet. You know, there's this range of timbre, range of frequency, mainly dynamic range. Now, you've got a guitar, which is basically whang like that, And you've got to fit, say, a singer on top of it. The only way you're going to be able to do it is by compressing the hell out of it, because a distortion box, a distorted electric guitar amp, you have to think of it like a compressor that is on set for infinity to one. It's mashing against the power supply rails. It's like, there it is. It's a giant square wave. And so it's sort of... I remember at a certain point in my career when I was faced with a jazz trio, upright bass, reeds, and a drum set. And I set up some mics, and I didn't even EQ them, and I positioned them well. And what was coming in the control room sounded like a record immediately. I thought, well, this is so easy. I don't have to EQ anything. It's natural sounds. It sounds amazing. You know, the band came in, they're like, well, what a great recording. I thought, wow, this jazz thing, you know, I should do this. And, you know, and of course, as soon as you have a wall of Marshalls, you end up, like, EQing everything to fit. You end up doing crazy EQ curves to get things, you know, otherwise natural-sounding instruments to poke through this wall of guitar that you're now competing with. You know, maybe the drums have got to be a lot brighter. You've got to add high-end to things so that they have, you know, there's parts of the frequency range you're competing with. And all that stuff about recording naturally with no EQ, it's all completely out the window once you're dealing with the giant white noise generator. So that became the struggle of my career, actually, because in the late 80s, okay, the grunge explosion happens, and here comes Mudhoney walking into my studio, and each of them are playing through two fuzz boxes in series. You know, and I'm thinking, like, really? You really want it to sound this distorted? Can we back it off, like, 5%, you know, or something like that? Which was absolute heresy. So I had to learn how to record in that, under those circumstances. So I've learned, I have a fairly elaborate way of thinking about guitar. There's a lot to it that I've learned over the years. And I'm going to just take you through the signal chain, basically starting with the fingers and the strings and just going down through it. And we're going to talk about each aspect of it and how the problems I have to solve when I'm recording a rock band with an electric guitar player. We're not here to talk about drums. That would be another story. So let me mark this here. Okay, first things first, we have a guitar of varying quality. Now, this guitar was a $25 guitar I got at Goodwill. It's by a company called First Act. They make amazingly good quality guitars for the money. It's shocking. I put a $75 pickup in it. And, you know, I've played gigs with this guitar. It actually, you know, works, shall we say. The neck is decent. The frets are in the right places. It's, you know, I was able to intonate it and line it up. So you start with the strings. And I can tell you that heavier strings are going to sound better than lighter strings. You won't be able to play Eruption on your guitar, but the first thing you have to deal with is tuning the damn thing. Okay, and I wrote a paper which is on my website, jackandino.com, and it's the most highly trafficked part of my website 15 years after I wrote it. It is called Guitar Tuning Nightmares Explained. And I'll just run you through the easy points of it really quickly. The problem with tuning a stringed instrument like the guitar, and I think it's true of any stringed instrument, is that the tuning is a moving target. When you strike a string, the initial attack of the string is sharp. So let me see if I can get some tiny volume. Interesting thing is, back when we had tuners with needles on them, I used to think that the needle was overshooting when you plucked it out, and you had to wait for the needle to settle down. And the fact is, when you pluck a string horn, the tuning actually goes over to the right and then settles down. As you can see here, past the green, there's the green, now it's over there. So striking the string, we have a range already of plus or minus 25 cents. So the question is, and this is a characteristic of, I think, all stringed instruments. Now, strings that have low tension on them do this more. Strings with high tension don't do it nearly as much. You can see how the high E string would be very easy to tune. Now, what do I do with the low E? Do I tune to the beginning of the note, or do I tune to the end of the note? What am I going to do? So that depends on what kind of player I am. If I'm a very light player and I don't pick very hard, I'm probably going to tune like this. Okay. Here I am. I'm more or less in tune. Now, suppose I'm a rock and roll guy and I do this. You see how far over that shoots? Okay, so then this becomes a problem if you're playing like this or you're playing like that. And this is what I have to deal with every day in the studio with rock bands, because there's always somebody out of tune. And they look at their tuner and they go, oh, I'm perfectly in tune. It says I'm in tune. And then they go, and I go, well, you know, and then I have to go through this whole rigmarole. And the other thing you have to remember, metal bands in particular. Now, this thing that I'm showing you, it does it the most on the low E string, a little less on the A string, hardly at all on the high strings. Now, imagine a bass. So this is what I hear with popular music over and over. And I've heard this for years. For years of my life, I noticed this before I knew the reason for it. You hear a record on the radio, maybe something that was recorded in the early 70s, like, you know, an R&B thing or something. And I would think, okay, the guitar and the vocal are in tune. The bass is sharp. The keyboards and the horns are flat. Why is this? And it took me years to realize that what's actually happening is that the keyboards and the horns are in tune. Sometimes horns are flat just because of whatever. But you can assume the keyboards, particularly the electronic ones, are probably in tune. The guitar is going to be 4 or 5 cents sharp. The bass is going to be anywhere from 10 to 14 cents sharp, commonly, not always. Again, it depends on if you're a light, tasty bass player or a rock and roll guy doing this. So I get punk bands in, and, you know, they record, and then we go to throw a Hammond track on it or something like that, and the keyboard is like, just sounds terribly flat. It's because of the nature of the player. If you are a palm muting kind of guy, like this, I'm not doing a very good job demonstrating it, but actually, the string's going flat. Oh, the other thing is, the tuner has got to be upstream from everything else. I've only got it downstream from the pedals here, just so you can see it more easily. But you normally want the tuner first thing in the chain. Here's another trick with tuning, and I can't really do it here on this guitar, but basically, the string generates harmonics, depending on where you pluck it and depending on where you're listening to it. If you pluck it here, you're going to get more of the fundamental frequency, which is the length of the entire string ringing. If you pluck it here, you're going to get a little more of the next harmonic, which is the string vibrating in a mode that's like half and half, like that. That's the harmonic point that's two octaves above the fundamental. One octave, two octaves. If you pluck the string here, anyway, the tuner is looking for the fundamental frequency of the note. And the more noisy it is and the more you're picking down here, all that extra timbre can fool the tuner a little bit. So if you want to have an easy time tuning your guitar, pick it here, however hard you're going to do it, and switch to your neck pickup if you have one. You can see I don't in this case. But you're going to have an easier time tuning your guitar if you're on this. If you want to really make it easy, roll your tone knob off. Because again, all those high frequencies have nothing to do. The tuner's looking for the lowest note that the guitar is making, the fundamental frequency of the string. It doesn't care about the twang and the shrill stuff. So, and then you just got to remember to switch it all back when you start the next song. Give me a moment to reboot my brain. So because of the way the strings act, if you have heavier strings, they won't do this sort of thing. Now, if you're a really hard player, you may want to actually flat your low E string a little bit. So that when you hit it really hard, it doesn't ring really sharp. Now it helps if you never, let's see. Okay, now if I play it quietly, you can tell that the E string is really flat. But if I'm doing this, it sounds in tune. So welcome to my world in the studio on a daily basis. Especially if you got one guy with a Strat and one guy with a Les Paul. One guitar is longer scale than the other. The frets are in slightly different places. And, you know, one guy might have light strings, the other guy might have heavy strings. And we have the source of much sorrow. Hence my article, Guitar Tuning Nightmares Explained, because that was kind of nightmare number one. There's other nightmares associated with guitar, like the fact that on a lot of guitars, this, which is called the nut, is frequently a little too high, which means the strings, when you're fretting a string here, hey, look, it's nice, it's in tune. You go down the neck. But now try fretting in the first position. It's super sharp. Might be in tune here. Might be in tune here. In the case of this guitar, that nut is too tall. Now, one designer, which was Gretsch, solved this with something called a zero fret. They had a fret right here, which the strings went across before they went through the nut. So you didn't have that issue. Unfortunately, that's a problem with a lot of cheap guitars, and unfortunately a lot of expensive guitars as well. I'll do an E chord, and I'm going to squeeze it a little extra. It's even worse now because I'm squeezing this G string. You can see the difference just based on how hard I'm clenching the neck, whether it's in tune or super sharp. And this is all very within the range of what a normal guitar player might do if they're not paying very close attention to their left hand. So, guitar, basically just assume that it's impossible to get it perfectly in tune, start from there, and then figure out how to work around it. Yes, and again, what style of player are you? How heavy are your strings? How much do you have to temper a little by flatting the low strings so that when you're actually playing your punk rock song, it sounds like it's in tune? And then you have to do the same thing with the bass. Because if you get a pick player and he's whacking the shit out of the bass, excuse my French, I find punk rock bass players playing, say, a Fender Precision, they record the track and later I have to do a pitch shift of maybe minus 14 cents on the bass. That is not rare for me to have to do that to get it in tune with the guitars. Now, the guitar players, being guitar players, they will commonly do multiple guitar tracks. They'll do, oh yeah, we're going to double the guitars, and then we're going to reinforce the chorus with this other part, and then we've got this octave thing we're going to do on the bridge. Oh yeah, and then we're going to overdub the solo. Meanwhile, the poor bass player, he's got one track. So from my standpoint, would I rather retune the bass track or leave the bass the way it is and recut all the guitar tracks to match the bass that's sharp? No, the bass player loses. So, you know, I like keeping the bass track, and this is one thing I do generally when I record bands. I try to capture the basic tracks live, and I'm also a very big opponent of click tracks, and that is a personal aesthetic of mine. You have to point a gun at me to get me to use a click track in the studio because I like the feel of musicians playing in real time. I value that above all else. It keeps me interested in what I'm doing. It keeps the music alive. And, you know, there are bands that come in and record that have always recorded with a click track because they thought, that's just how you do it. And I say, no, it's not just how you do it. It's not how I've been doing it for 30 years, and nobody's complained about my records, you know. And you know, you get, it's like training wheels. You got to get them to, you know, just leave the training wheels aside and play some real music in real time. Let the music breathe a little bit. But this is another discussion having nothing to do with this. I have my aesthetic anyway, and I'm a nice guy in the studio. I don't like, I'm not Mr. Whatever. I don't force my aesthetic on people, but I make sure people know what my preferences are so they know who they're working with. So, guitars. Okay, tuners. Now, this is a thing. See, this thing, it's called a snark. It's this little deal that they've... This is a great invention, by the way, but I'm going to tell you why I can't stand them. It clips onto the neck like this. And in theory, it allows you to tune. And in theory, it works fairly well. I don't know, you can't quite see it, but it's got a little LED display on there. And it basically just works off the vibrations through the body. Which would be all well and good, except that whenever I have people using these in the studio, I end up having much more tuning problems. Because apparently they look accurate, but they're not. There's a little too much slop in these things. And so I recommend, like, you know, I think these are probably designed more for instruments with more resonance, like hollow bodies, you know, and acoustic guitars and, you know, maybe violins and things like that. Anything with a lot of real lively resonating body probably gives this tuner a lot to work with. But a solid body electric guitar, which is designed not to resonate that much, because the idea of a solid body guitar is that you can crank the hell out of it and it won't start uncontrollably feeding back. At the same time, it's not giving this very much to work with. So be cautious. These are all the rage right now, but I always have to, you know, I go, if somebody's out of tune, and it's always the guy using one of those things. And I go in the house and I grab my Roland chromatic tuner here, and I say, here, you can use mine. I just put a battery in it. Now you'll notice I have a stack of pedals in front of me here. The only one that has a power supply, and we'll get to that, is this thing called a hum debugger. We'll talk about that in a minute. One of the big problems with guitars is noise. You have two kinds of pickups. You have what's called a humbucking pickup. And I'm not entirely sure how this works, but there's some kind of voodoo involved in how they wind it, which causes some kind of noise cancellation to occur. And by noise, there apparently is around us at all times, everywhere in any large city, magnetic fields. They're always 60 cycles based on the power grid, which surrounds us on all sides. And it can be, you know, you don't know where the nearest line transformer is. I don't know where the sources of all these are, but unless you're in a perfect Faraday cage, meaning a room with like metal walls, you're going to have this kind of strange noise thing that happens. I'm trying to get the intermediate. The intermediate noise thing. This one's not doing it, so we're in a pretty good room for noise fields. I'm impressed, actually. Okay, there's the loud orientation. It's fairly subtle. Where I am in Ballard, at the Studio Soundhouse where I work at, there's a particular orientation where everybody ends up standing when they're in the room recording. And it's approximately east by northeast, you know. And if they're facing that way or 180 degrees out from it, their guitar suddenly becomes quiet. And this is particularly crucial with single coil pickups, which do not cancel noise. And I'm always like, wait a minute, when you start the song or end it, remember to face your guitar at that corner of the room right over there. You know, and everyone forgets, of course, and so the song fades out in the last chord, and you hear this like, that's left over, and you're just, okay, whatever, I'll deal with it. So humbucking versus single coils. Teles are very notorious with their single coils. I think the only guitar I have here is this Mutation guitar, which we'll get to, has a noisy pickup in it. I might use as an example. Oh, dear. Don't even get me started on the even-tempered Western scale. I addressed that in part 3 of the paper that's on my website, because the equal-tempered 12-tone Western scale actually prevents us from playing a lot of intervals perfectly in tune on an equal tempered instrument. Fourths and fifths are good. Thirds and sevenths are not so good. I'll leave it at that. It's another can of worms. Let's see. Oh, yeah, microphonic pickups. Now, this is interesting. Check, 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 check. Hello. So, the pickup can act like a microphone. That's the easy way to tell which pickup you're switched on, but this can be a problem. You also can get something. There's two kinds of feedback you can get. You can get acoustic feedback, like that. I'm trying to spare your ears. But you can also get magnetic squeal. Yeah, okay, I don't have enough gain to do that, and I'm not going to assault your ears with it, but there's a difference. One thing you have to be careful with guitar players who are using extreme distortion in the studio is they're wearing headphones, and there's a headphone cable, and it's usually coming down from their head, and it's coiled all around their body in some kind of weird way, or it's through their guitar, and if it goes anywhere near the guitar cable, you get feedback coupling. You get magnetic coupling from the headphones, which are probably at ear bleed volume, typically, and the guitar itself. And you wind up hearing the headphone mix coming through the guitar. And you go, wait a minute, and I have to go out and just carefully, rearrange the cable so that the headphone is kind of over here, the cable is not coiled around. There's another thing which I call musician Coriolis effect, which is basically, you get certain, and singers are notorious for this, actually. I took the guitar if I could show you this, but basically, they'll have the mic, or they'll have their guitar, and they'll step, and they'll go to the amp, and they'll go away, and they'll play like this. And then, when it's time to adjust it, they'll do this, and they'll adjust it, and then they'll come back like this. And pretty soon, everything is twisted and crazy, because they're a clockwise person, or maybe they're a counterclockwise person. It depends on which hemisphere you're in, I suppose. So there's that, keeping the cabling and the signal path clean. Another thing you got to worry about all the time, and I ran into this yet again just yesterday in the studio, when I had a guitar player plugged all his pedals in, and he's all ready to go, and it's going, and so I'm going, okay, problem-solving mode, what are we doing here? And it turns out he had one of his series of cables was a speaker cable. Now, a speaker cable is not shielded. And most of the time, it looks exactly like a guitar cable. I try and keep that. I have specific speaker cables that do not look like guitar cables. You know what I mean? It looks like the cable that would go to your lamp or something. You can see that it's not shielded. But a lot of cables, you have to look. You have to basically hold it up and kind of squint at it in the light and kind of go, oh, yeah, I think it's a speaker cable there, but it's all worn off. So I end up. I end up dealing with that all the time. And sometimes in the unlikeliest places, the phantom speaker cable. All right, that's enough on that end of things. Let's move to the distortion itself. So I already gave you some idea of how I think about distorted guitar, which is it's a wall of white noise. And I'm thinking to myself, this is why my dad's generation probably had such a hard time dealing with electric guitars. Because imagine you grew up on Glenn Miller, Count Basie, Ellington, whatever. It's all real instruments with real attack and decay parameters, with holes in the music, with space. You could hear everything. Things have their place. They take turns. And then here comes the guitar, like that. And it's a generational shift. And I know my dad hated that stuff. He couldn't stand it. He was an Ellington guy to his dying day. I have to say the other thing, electric instruments in general, imagine the Hammond organ, same thing. Okay, imagine keyboards before electronics, and you've got, everything was somewhat percussive. Of course, you had pump organs and things like that, but even they sort of had a volume that depended on how hard you're pumping the damn thing. But you've got a Hammond, which is, again, linear. You do have a volume pedal, but as they're used now, you don't see that as much because they're competing with guitars, so they have to be on the whole time. So electronic instruments changed the whole game and the whole picture of dynamics in popular music. So, all right, now here we go. Let's talk about distortion. So you've got harmonics that are generated, and I'm going to give you a sampling of each kind of thing. Of course, I'm way out of tune again. Let me spare your... I'm using my little floor tuner here. Let's get the $25 guitar in tune, shall we? I love the idea of a $25 guitar that I can play a show with. And if I get really angry and I smash it, it'll be like, whatever. You know, but I would never do that. I would never do that. Somewhere there's a teenager who would love to have that guitar that you just smashed. I can never keep that out of my mind. So whenever anyone smashes a guitar, I'm always like, oh, it had a soul. So, you know, but, you know, then there are sacrificial guitars, though, sometimes. This one is too good to be a sacrificial guitar. Anyway, so there's clean. And this is like a basic clean circuit. Fender Bassman, classic circuit. People have been imitating this circuit for decades. I, of course, couldn't leave well enough alone and had to make one channel be a high gain channel. Which is actually the one I use the most. The other channel is stock. It's exactly as it was designed. Just a little cleaner. Okay, so styles of distortion pedal. The simplest one is the line booster. All it does is just boost the level of the signal, so which allows the amp to do the distorting if that's your cup of tea. Hence, like that. Then you've got the tube screamer style, I call it, because it's this basically like four or five fundamental flavors of pedal, and everything else is kind of a variation.
I'm going to match the volume levels a little better here.
Because I don't want to kill people. That's a tube screamer. It's generating a lot of nice harmonics, I like to say. Harmonics that are small, even numbers, you know, octaves, second, fourth harmonics, maybe some thirds. I don't know, but the whole idea is this pedal, this is the green pedal, the TS9. It's a bit of a classic. It's supposed to be imitating a slightly overdriven tube amp, which is fun because people usually end up overdriving tube amps with them. That goes for the so-called sans amp pedals that are designed to simulate an amp. People just drive amps with them, so you have like an amp driving an amp. Nothing's ever used the way it was designed. So there's that. And then you've got the next flavor, which is the rat.
Let me turn the volume down so I'm not hurting anybody.
Okay. And then we have the classic, and this is the one I really don't like this pedal, but I have to deal with it. Okay, wait a minute.
Down, behave. This is the Big Muff.
Designed in, I think, 1971, maybe earlier. Don't you love it? Pure white noise. Now, if you're this kind of player, here's your sound. You recognize that. It's not quite the same when you do it like this. So that kind of pedal basically ends up defining your playing style. If that's the kind of sound you have, you end up evolving an entirely different way of picking and muting, and your whole approach to the instrument becomes different if that's going to be your sound. And I mean, Exhibit A would be Metallica. And then finally we have this pedal, which I'm going to show you what it is.
Because, and someone gave me this pedal a few years ago, and
they said, Jack, you need this pedal. I said, why? What is it? He says, it's a grunge pedal. And I said, okay, I guess I need this pedal. And I realized it's designed to imitate one of the other essential flavors, which is the Super Fuzz, which is a brand. I don't actually own one, but it's like the Big Muff, but it has a kind of a growl, a little sizzly snarl to it.
So you've got all these flavors, and then if you want to get ridiculous and really drive me crazy, what have I done? Oh, yeah, the old cable part.
You put them all on. I'll spare you. Except that I have had real bands do that and make records in the studio. So you're left with it. You can hear, if you have the ears for it, you can hear that the fundamental musical part of the tone is being blended with more and more pure white noise. Or maybe it's pink noise. I don't know. Rick, who knows? It's noise anyway. It's basically, you know, it's a, essentially you're mixing non-musical, non-emotional components with musical emotional components. And if the there's something, and the way I've learned to think of it is I call it uncorrelated white noise, because there is correlated noise, which is harmonics that are related mathematically to what you're actually playing, being something more like this.
Sorry, this thing is loud here. So that's kind of a somewhat
that's a kind of a musical distortion.
This one, a little more edgy, but still pleasant. This one.
Okay, it just ate the signal. You can hear that the signal is now submersed in this.
And this was a problem
with a lot of the grunge bands, because they didn't realize that as soon as you step on it, your music goes away. You see. And so you would have to turn the volume up on the pedal to full bore. I won't do that to you right now. Or I would have to automate it in the studio and just like, okay, there's the spot where he stepped on the pedal and all his mid-range went away. We'll automate the EQ and we're going to boost the 1K right there and turn the volume up and so forth. I had to do that. I mean, you can hear that. It's right there on About a Girl on the Bleach album. He steps on a Big Muff right in the middle of it for the solo and the sound kind of sucks away and I had to crank it up when I mixed it. And this was a trademark of the grunge bands is they didn't really realize that your musical part of the signal is goes away and is replaced with like that. Now, if you play through that sound the whole time, you don't have to worry about it, but the whole, like, stepping on it in between. Anyway, I've had to deal with that a lot. So this is the other thing that this kind of distortion does. It destroys, like, all the low frequencies become uncorrelated rumble. There's this low end coming out that really has nothing to do with what you're playing. And it can completely obliterate all the clarity in your mix. You're trying to get the kick drum and the bass to do what they do. And you've got this guitar kind of going like that. This kind of just this generated sort of, it's just nasty. And, you know, I end up like just everything below 200 hertz gone. You know, when I'm EQing it in the mix and suddenly like, oh, it sounds, suddenly everything clears up. So, let's see. Oh yeah, another thing. All my pedals here, you'll notice, well, you can't notice, you probably can't see them. They all have batteries in them. And I'm a big fan of batteries, especially in the studio, because these little power supplies, these things, this is a typical one, actually, but there's one that's a little skinnier one that everybody has now. It's a brand name. It's called a OneSpot. And I didn't hear, I just started hearing this name. People would go, oh, have you got a OneSpot? I was like, what are you talking about? Oh, you mean a power supply? Oh, yeah. You know, it's become a name like Kleenex because this company, OneSpot, makes these little generic power supplies for pedals. Now, the thing with these things is they usually have, like, five or six of these little connectors on them, daisy chain. So you can plug like all your pedals into one power supply. Now the downside of this and Rick, you may know this, basic power supply theory, the more current you're drawing from the power supply, the worse the regulation gets, and the more AC bleeds into the DC that it's trying to put out. And your pedals get noisier and noisier. You get more and more 60-cycle hum. And certain pedals, a lot of pedals, like certain delay and, you know, digital kind of pedals, draw lots of current. You know, they might draw like, you know, 70, 80 milliamps, whereas this rad is probably drawing on the order of 2 milliamps of power. And a standard original Crybaby, I measured this actually. I made a little table of the current that was drawn by various pedals. I think the original Crybaby Wah draws like 1 milliamp of power. Like a battery lasts for a year if you remember to unplug it when you walk away from it. And the old rad that doesn't have an LED in it, it's like 2 milliamps. It's something. And then you've got like the Digitech delay pedal, you know, that it draws like, you know, 200 milliamps of power or whatever. So your battery goes dead after about, you know, like an hour. And that's the thing is I've had people set up their giant pedal boards in the studio, which, of course, they're only using two of those pedals on the song that you're about to record. But they're all mounted to the board and you can't move them and bypass them because the little cables, it can't get them out, you know. And because I'm always telling people, look, you're not using some of these pedals. They're all eating your signal. Because a lot of pedals are not true bypass, meaning when you step on the pedal, the signal doesn't go straight from the input to the output. It goes through some sort of buffer circuit. And that might be good, but if you have seven or eight pedals in a row, you're degrading your signal with each one, even if all the pedals are off. Like if when you unplug the pedal and take the power away from it, the signal goes away, that means it's not what we call true bypass. It's going through circuitry even when you don't have the pedal activated. So you get noise on top of noise on top of noise, plus maybe having a power supply that's not adequate at filtering it. And all those cables are picking up noise. And, you know, I always tell people, look, you're only using a distortion and a wah in this song. Can we, like, unplug the other seven pedals that it's going through right now just to record the song? And things work much better that way. So some of the things to deal with. I'm not a big fan of the one spots. I like the battery thing. It's pure DC, baby. The amp. Okay, now we've gone down the signal chain. Okay, here's an amp. Oh, my goodness. Okay, tubes versus transistors, all right? It's kind of a red herring, but there is something to it. Tubes have a particular character that is very sought after, but we have to remember that other characteristics of tube amps are giant transformers that the signal is going through. You've got transformer hysteresis that is taking place in the output transformer. The output transformer is like, that's like 20 pounds of iron. And you've also got something that these amps do, which is that the power supply sags a little bit as you put more and more, as you're driving more and more power through, which means it acts a little bit like a compressor, which is kind of desirable, actually, if you're, you know, that kind of person. Tube amps remain popular, and here's another thing I have to deal with in the studio all the time, is people come in and they plug it in and turn it on, and it goes, wah, and I think, okay, and I unplug everything from it, the amp is still sitting there going, with nothing plugged into it. I'm thinking, capacitors, filters, power supply, okay, you know, and because there's components in the amp that, with tubes sitting right under them generating 200 degrees of heat, capacitors and things that are electrolytic and have liquids in them, they get cooked and dried out after like 10 or 20 years, and they have to be replaced because they stop doing their job of cleaning up the sound that the amp is running off of. So I've actually gone to foreign countries and ended up recapping amplifiers. Another thing is you ask people, when were the tubes replaced? And they say, well, those are the tubes that I bought the amp with. When was that? Well, 1992. You know, tubes have a lifetime depending on how heavily you use them, and it varies wildly because tubes are all over the map in terms of quality control. But it's nice if they're reasonably new because their characteristics get wildly out of spec after a while. They may still work, they may not. And there's something called biasing and balancing the tubes, which is best. It's not really something I want to explain that you know, you could kill yourself if you tried to do it if you didn't know what you were doing with it. Because there's like, you know, 500 volts DC in the amp.
So, but I've ended up biasing amps. I've ended up replacing tubes. I've ended up, I didn't even get into intonating the guitar, which has to do with these little things here. These are the bridge saddles of the guitar, and these are movable. They're adjustable this way or that way, depending on how you want it to be set. And the purpose of this is, it's another way of looking at it, is it allows you to change the locations of the frets so that a note can be in tune here and also in tune up here. Because you can't move the frets around, it allows you to move to essentially change the length of the string until the string's harmonic points and everything happen to line up exactly where they should or the frets. And again, very often people have never had their guitars adjusted in that way, and I end up doing it in the studio all the time because sooner or later somebody plays a part way up on the neck here and I hear that, well, you know, that's like way out of tune. Wait a minute, give me your guitar, give me 5 minutes, let me have a screwdriver. And I end up doing a quick and dirty intonation adjustment on their guitar. It's a part of the service, you know what I mean? I fix amps, I intonate guitars. You do whatever you got to do to get the record made. It's a lot of what I end up doing is problem solving. And there are many problems that can be solved. So, amps. Yes. Oh, another thing that happens sometimes with the tubes. Well, this is lovely. Let me see if I can make it do it. Tubes get microphonic with time. Ooh, these are nice. They're not doing it. Okay, I'm too good with maintaining my amps. I have no microphonic tubes in here. Occasionally, the tubes themselves act like microphones. And if your amp is sitting on top of, you know, or maybe you've got a twin where the speakers are directly under the tubes, you'll be sitting there doing nothing, and your amp will suddenly start going, and it'll be whistling. And you go over and you go like that, and it stops. And you walk away, and it starts again. It's usually a tube that's getting microphonic because it's basically acting like it's amplifying itself. The vibrations that the tube is, like it's the internal components in the tube have come loose, and you know the plates in it that have a charge across them are doing this, and it's basically generating its own signal and then amplifying it. It's going out to the speaker, and it's, you get a feedback loop of acoustic oscillation, and you know that's time to replace the tubes when that happens.
It's quite common. Turn it down so it's not on 10 anymore. That's a nice quiet amp because I baby it. So we come to the speakers. So speakers, speaker technology, I don't know if it's, I'm still kind of in, it's kind of amazed that we are still using transducers based on moving coils. How many decades after the moving coil speaker was invented? Rick, do you know?
1920-something.
We're still using this same basic technology. I mean, there's been variations, and there's horns and everything, but there's usually a moving coil of wire somewhere pushing on some thing that is causing air to move. And I mean, yeah, there's been electrostatic tweeters and crazy stuff that doesn't seem to have caught on, I guess, unless you have a lot of money. But we're still using a basic, am I right? I mean,
does it play loud?
Well, there's that, you know, right. So, and let me show you another thing. Oh, this is great. Hold on. Things you have to have when you're in the studio. Okay, wait a minute. I see that I've thought ahead of myself here. Earplugs, hello. I carry them with me all the time. Okay, battery is really useful, and I'll show you exactly why, if you can see it from here. Let me put this on standby. So, one thing I like doing is miking multiple speakers, and the reason for that is that speakers generate their own sort of distortion. I call it fizzy paper distortion. And one thing is higher wattage speakers that are designed for 75 or 100 watts, they have heavier magnets in them. Thicker magnetic coil structures that are oscillating around the magnet. Generally, the paper cones are more rigid to withstand the giant wattage that you're putting in. They have to be able to do this a lot. Whereas low wattage speakers, the so-called greenbacks or 25s or vintage 30s, that's some of the common names that you see for low wattage vintage style speakers. To my ears, they sound
papery. I'll say papery because the cones are not very rigid and they make this kind of weird fizzy sound that it's very recognizable when I hear it on a recording. And if I have a guy who's playing through like a cabinet full of 25 watt speakers, well, I have a cabinet in my studio that's got 75 watt speakers in it. Same amp, same sound, same guitar, same pedals. All you do is change speakers and suddenly the sound can change dramatically just based on what brand of speaker or what type of speaker you're using. And it's, you know, it's usually we'll be like, okay, this one, oh, that's the cabinet we're going to use for the record. And it's usually immediately obvious to everybody which one is the better sounding one. And most of the time, not always, but most of the time, it's the higher wattage speakers that's come out ahead because they don't have that papery fizz sound. Now, the lower wattage speakers can be louder. They're more efficient. They're moving less mass. But the tone can be kind of thin and bright, and it's... Anyway, these are 50-watt speakers. They're not the best. But I'm going to show you something else that happens when people come into the studio, especially touring bands. They've been blowing speakers up, having them replaced. Say they have a 4x12 or one of those crazy bass cabs that's like a refrigerator. It's, you know, 8 10-inch speakers in those big Ampeg cabs that, you know, that come up to here. I hate those things because I don't have a very good back. And I don't even want to see them. I'm just like, no, I will not touch it. But I will generally put, you know, a couple different flavors of mic on a cab just to give me some options. The speakers are not always in phase, especially if someone worked on them on the road. And you know, we blew a speaker and we replaced it in San Francisco when we were on the road, you know. And you set the mics up and you go, wait a minute, the top right speaker is out of phase with the other three. And one of the ways to test it, all you need is a battery. Basically, just take a 9-volt battery, you go like this, and you watch what the speakers do. You can't really see it from here. In this case, yeah, you can't see it. I can see that the speakers are moving outward ever so slightly when I do this. If I flip them around, they suck in ever so slightly. I can see it from here. I'm sorry, it's just not obvious enough. Those are not high excursion speakers. And basically, if these are out of tune and I did this with a battery, one speaker would go out, one speaker would go in, and which means the cabinet is going to be about half as loud subjectively when you plug in and play through it as it should be, because they're literally the energy is being canceled. And you know, I've also had people on stage with, you know, who show up with, this is my stage ring. I have a Laney amp here and I've got a Marshall over here, and I set up the mics and they're 180 degrees out of phase. And I go, okay, you know what? So I made myself a special cable that I keep at Soundhouse, which is a phase-flipped speaker cable, you know, with one end swapped, you know, and just specifically for these situations because, you know, you have two amps that might be in the same room, and yeah, sure, you can mic them and flip the phase on the console of the mic input, but they're still canceling in the air. You know, there's going to be some weird interaction there that maybe is not what you want. So I'll pull out the phase flip speaker cable. The other thing you have to deal with sometimes is a typical tube amp, and we're going to look at this. I wish I could show you the schematic. It would mean nothing to you, but the typical basic classic tube amp schematic, each tube stage. This isn't true of every tube stage. I'm not talking cathode followers here. The typical tube stage flips the phase 180 degrees each stage that it goes through. Inside the amp, it goes like this. Next tube, it does that. Next tube, it does that. So the interesting thing about this is, say a Fender Twin has a particular tube stage that it goes through. The other side, it has like a side of the amp that is like the clean side, and then it has a side that's the reverb side. You know, the reverb only works on this side of a Fender Twin. It doesn't work on this channel. Well, there's an extra tube stage that is used to blend the signal from the reverb into the signal that flips the phase. So on your typical Fender Twin, this channel and this channel will be out of phase with each other. So it also depends on which channel the guy's using. On a typical Marshall, the low volume input is going through one less tube stage than the high gain input. So depends on, you know, which one are you getting, actually. And if you start doing multiple mics and multiple amps, you have to be very aware of this. I particularly had this happen when I was using, I had High on Fire in the studio, and they were big Soldano amp users. And we were using a Soldano SLO. Now, Mike Soldano had his shop right down in Ballard. He's just retired, actually. The building's for sale, which is terrible, because I used to go down there and, you know, borrow, you know, like it's like borrowing a cup of sugar. I'd be like, I need a 100K pot, you know. And he's, well, I've got a bunch on the show here. Just take one, you know. So he's gone. But basically, I was there in the studio 10 years ago with High on Fire, and they had Soldano's amp, and Mike knows about them. They endorse his amps and everything. Okay, amp doesn't work. So, oh, well, we'll call Mike, and maybe we can get a loaner from him. You know, it's great when your amp guy lives in the same city. So I go down to Mike, and he says, oh, here's, take my, I'm going to give you Mr. Science. And Mr. Science was his first one of this amp. It was like his the one that he perfected the design with. He said, this is exactly the same circuit as the production model, you know what I mean? So, but, you know, it's whatever, take it, and then I'll fix your amp, and I'll get it back to you in a couple of days. So we go back to the studio, plug the amp in, set the knobs the same, and go to continue recording. And we were using two amps at the time, this and one of my amps, and I immediately discover it's out of phase 180 degrees versus what I had before. And then I go, oh, this amp, he hadn't put the effects loop in it yet, the effects loop circuit. I go, Mike, does your effects loop circuit flip the phase? And he goes, I think it does. You know, I was like, okay. You know, so there's another example, you know. Hey, well, whatever, we just did the cable thing. So things to watch out for. You'll end up with cabinets that are out of phase or speakers that are out of phase within the same cabinet. There's a lot of things that can screw you up in the studio.
Jack?
Yeah?
Have you run into people that use a Y cable and plug into both channels at once?
Both?
The normal and the verb channel?
I've seen people jump ring them. It doesn't work on Fenders.
Yeah, because of the phase flip.
Yes, it doesn't work. I mean, it kind of works if one channel is louder than the other. That's right. The one you're going to hear.
Really different tone settings?
Yeah, I mean, it's not good.
They'll try anything, though.
Yeah, no, I know, they'll do that. And there's a certain kind of Marshall flavor where it's very standard to do that, actually. And it works. But in a lot of amps, it doesn't. So here's another thing. Multiple amps, multiple speakers versus multiple amps. Now, I like using different flavors of microphone. On, say, a given cabinet has like four speakers. I'll have like a, you know, a dynamic here and maybe a ribbon over here, and they have totally different frequency responses. But you can combine them together and get something that sounds better and more interesting than either one by itself. And I'll give you some examples in a minute, because I've got a couple of example Pro Tools sessions, but I'm having too much fun talking. When you get into multiple amps, it's interesting because if you have the same source signal, now I have a splitter that's passive. There are also splitters that are active and have buffers and ground lifts and whatnot. But usually I end up using a passive signal splitter somewhere between the last pedal and the amps. And this is another thing. You AES guys can maybe tell me why this persists in being the case. Because whenever I use two guitar amps that are both connected, I get a ground lift. And the only way around it is by putting a ground lift on one of the power supplies, you know, the 3 into 2, the little orange thing that you use, which is like, it's not according to code. It's not legal. I mean, I'm sure there's laws against it. I mean, it's a terrible solution, but it's the only solution sometimes. And I think it's just maybe having to do with amps that were designed 40 years ago that people are still using. I don't know the reason for that, but I always have a handful of ground lifts with me at all times. And sometimes you need them on stage. You know, you get on stage and you walk up to the mic, you got your guitar, and you go to sing, and you get a big freaking shock off the mic. And it's like, okay, either something isn't grounded or something has a ground loop, but whatever it is, I don't like it. I also carry a foam thing that I put over the mic sometimes for times like that when I don't want to argue with the live sound guys. It's like, okay, I'll deal with this. Multiple amps, if you get two amps with wildly different distortion characteristics, say somebody shows up with this horrible Big Muff thing, One thing I will do is I'll record a DI of the guitar, a direct signal, and I won't even listen to it. It's just, it goes to a channel in Pro Tools, and it just, there it is. And I'll group it with the mic signals. And the mic signals on the screen will basically just look like a 2x4. You know, it's just, there it is. But then you've got the direct signal, and you group it with them. And the direct signal, you can see every pick stroke exactly where it happened. And if later on you're mixing the record and you decide that you hate the sound, you can take the DI signal, reamp it through maybe an amp that I might like a little better, you know, a nice enharmonic, nice sounding guitar amp, and you can phase align it by nudging it around in Pro Tools or using various tricks, and blend it phase accurately with the crappy signal that the guy gave you from his horrible Marshall JCM 2000, or his horrible Mesa Boogie dual rectifier, which is like the worst amp in the entire universe in my world. Because the distortion it creates is completely uncorrelated, okay? It's pure uncorrelated white noise that amp makes. I don't know why people like it, but metal people love that amp. I'm not a fan. So, what was I getting at? Oh, the different kinds. Okay, so the DI signal is useful for editing because if somebody's ahead or behind the beat a little bit, you can't always tell if it's super distorted. You just know it sounds wrong. You can't figure out, is he ahead, is he behind? Then you look at the DI signal, which is grayed out. You know, you're not listening to it. And you can go, oh, he's ahead. There's the kick. There's the pick strokes. Okay, and then you grab it all, nudge, 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 and it's magic. It sounds great. You know, sometimes if I can, I'll just do that live. I'll have the guy's got his amp, and there's a gobo between them, and then, like, I've got my amp. Okay, let me plug my amp in here. Just ignore me. I'm going to get what I think is a good sound over here. You go ahead, do your worst with your amp, and I'm going to get my tone. And, you know, later you bring up the two faders, and everybody goes, oh, wow, how'd you get that sound, man? So, you know, you let them do what they're going to do, but then you make sure you have an out. let me give you an example. Now, one thing I've also found that's useful, and I can't really demonstrate it with a 2x12, but, okay, frequencies coming out of the speaker. High frequencies are like laser beams. They tend to be very directional. They go out like this. Low frequencies, extreme low frequencies especially, are not directional at all. They just go around corners. They ooze into everything. You know, they go out almost like a sphere. And high frequencies are like, they're more like a flashlight. In fact, if you visualize it like a flashlight, that's a good way to think about it. In fact, I think of my microphones like little flashlights when I'm miking up a drum kit. You know, I think, okay, do I want the flashlight that's pointing at the rack tom? Do I want it to be shining at the hi-hat? No, I don't. I want it to be not. I want it to be here. You know, so you think about that. Speakers are that way too. So you can completely change your tone by depending on where you put the speaker. So you put the mic in the center of the cone, like so, you're gonna get a crazy, bright, papery sound. As you move it out, like this, you're gonna get less of that direct high frequency stuff. Now, as you move it away from the cabinet, more and more of the low frequencies are just sort of, are coming out of the cabinet, just kind of going this way. High frequencies are going like that. So the farther away you get the mic, the more you're getting just the high-end parts of the amp, and the more you're getting the room, and the sound just gets more and more annoying the farther you get from the amp. So distant miking with distorted guitars generally ends up just with the signal just decaying into this horrible, shrill nightmare. It's different with clean tones if you're in a good room, you know. But one thing that's interesting is you can combine a close signal with a slightly more distant signal, and phase align it in Pro Tools, either visually by comparing the beginning of a note and seeing, trying to see if you can guess where the waveforms line up. You can do it easily if you phase flip one of them and then sort of like nudge it around until it cancels and then flip it back, and that's the point where they're adding together perfectly and the signals are lined up. One thing I found with a 4x12 cabinet, and I didn't have access to a truck today, so I couldn't bring one, but if you can imagine a 4x12, basically this times two, you have four speakers. They make a combined wavefront. And if you have a speaker, let's pretend I'm doing it with two speakers. You can position a mic that's equidistant between
the four speakers. I only have two here. And there's a point in front of a typical 4x12 cab that's about 20 to 22 inches out from the cab, where if you have a mic that's centered, and the 421 here, this old beast, happens to be a good mic for this sound, you can get a sound that's useful. If you get too close to the middle, you're missing all the speed. You're just getting sort of horrible, like, you know, you're basically miking the wood. If you get out too far, you're getting no low end at all. But there's a place that you can find, depending on the cabinet, where it will actually be a semi-useful sound if you blend it in with the close mic and phase align it. In this case, I'm going to have an example I will show you. I also have a funny session. I'll show you that too, because, okay, which mic do you use? One day I got, okay, this is the nice thing about recording studios is it's really a laboratory. You can do experiments. Anything you can think of, you can say, I want the data, you know, and, you know, you can look at waveforms and zoom in on things and change variables. And if you think of it scientifically, so one thing I was able to do is I did a mic shootout with about 25 mics, and I recorded a signal, just me strumming some chords, direct, put it in Pro Tools, routed it out to a reamp box, sent it to an amp, and I had a particular signal chain going, and it was just like a nice rock sound. I stepped back, and I put the thing on loop so it would just play, and the amp is just sitting there wanging away by itself. And so I positioned a mic, and I was very careful about this. I had a mic clip, I sort of like, okay, I know right about where the diaphragm is inside that little ball there, you know. And then I proceeded to just record the signal back into Pro Tools, and I would change the mic, line it up the same. I've tried to keep the mic and the clip in exactly the same position relative to the speaker each time. And I just did that for about 30 microphones. And I have the session, I can show it to you, and it'll play it through these little speakers. You might be able to get the idea. So it was pretty interesting, just the dramatic differences between mics and some of the not so dramatic differences. And that's a matter of taste as well. But let me get to a couple of examples. Because, yes, we're almost to the really difficult stuff.
So let me liven
this thing up,
Jack,
here. Yes.
Before we go there, it's 9:00.
Okay.
It's a perfect time for a break.
It's a perfect time because I don't have that much more. But I have the fun show and tell part here.
Brilliant. So
with the sessions.
10.
Yeah, drinks, bathroom, do it.
we have cookies and water. We have human.
Door prize.
Door prize, signed with me. So 10 minutes.